From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. When Larry H. Miller died in 2009, he left behind a thriving, multifaceted, multi-billion dollar conglomerate, spanning from cars to retail to entertainment, with the Utah Jazz as its crown jewel. But as the nation dipped into the Great Recession, Miller's death only added to the hand-wringing. Would the Miller Group of companies be able to survive without its empathetic, community-minded, and risk-taking leader? Today on the program, a look inside the financial powerhouse that Larry H. Miller built. Plus, an artist steeped in collaboration and a sense of place. We talk with painter Kim Schoenstatt, winner of this year's Doctorow Prize. All that and your calls coming up after the news. From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. When Larry H. Miller died in 2009, he left behind a thriving, multifaceted, multi-billion dollar conglomerate, spanning from cars to retail to entertainment, with the Utah Jazz as its crown jewel. But as the nation dipped into the Great Recession, Miller's death only added to the hand-wringing. Would the Miller Group of companies be able to survive without its empathetic, community-minded, and risk-taking leader? Today on the program, a look inside the financial powerhouse that Larry H. Miller built. Plus, an artist steeped in collaboration and a sense of place. We talk with painter Kim Schoenstatt, winner of this year's Doctorow Prize. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. During his dynamic life, Larry H. Miller built an empire of car dealerships, movie theaters, and of course, the Utah Jazz. And not even his recent death, a down economy, and an NBA strike are dulling Miller's business franchise. Joining us on the program to talk about an update on the Miller conglomerate is Mike Gorrell. He covers Salt Lake County and skiing for the Salt Lake Tribune, but he was on the business desk when the Larry H. Miller Group story began, and through most of its development, he's been at the Tribune for 28 years. He joins me here in studio. And Mike Gorrell, thanks so much for being here.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Also with us, Brian T. Smith is the Utah Jazz beat writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, and he joins us by phone from his home in Salt Lake City. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Later on in the program, we'll be talking with celebrated multimedia artist and painter Kim Schoenstatt. But first, the legacy of Larry H. Miller. Are you one of the 3,700 employees working at a Miller franchise? How have things been going since Miller's death in 2009? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. In your series that appeared in Sunday Salt Lake Tribune, you paint a portrait of a business empire that's thriving in the midst of such economic uncertainty. Brian T. Smith, what got you interested in this story and thinking about Larry H. Miller's legacy and how his companies are doing?
Yeah, I think there are two things. Number one, I started covering the Jazz about a year ago, so I always think one of the best things you can do as a beat writer is just to really, at some point, once you get through the games and the trades and the signings and the injuries, is to just really sit back, usually during the summer, look at what's the most interesting thing, short-term, long-term, of the team you're covering and dig in. And with the Jazz, that was obviously just, you know, what LHM really is, how it got to this point, how they've weathered the recession, how they're dealing with the lockout, and that transferred specifically into the lockout. The fact that the Jazz are a small market team in April, Greg Miller, the CEO and of the Jazz and LHM, told the Salt Lake Tribune that he had just gotten some new graphics showing that by one measure, the Jazz are the smallest market in the NBA, and we dealt with Sacramento, with the Kings last year, to where they came very, very close to relocating to Anaheim, which is a much larger market. They still might do that. Cleveland lost LeBron James. Many of the small market teams lost money. The Jazz lost money, Miller told the Salt Lake Tribune. So you put all that together with the lockout, with the economic uncertainty, with the competitive uncertainty, and it just seemed like a really good time to work with Mike Gorrell and the Tribune staff and dig into where is LHM at financially, where are the Jazz at financially, and where is this thing going to go as the lockout unfolds?
In your reporting, you had extensive access to Greg Miller, the successor in the Larry H. Miller Group. He's also the Utah Jazz CEO. Describe Greg Miller for us. Like father, like son?
Yeah, not really. I have to rely on reports. I have to rely on people like Mike Gorrell, Steve Loom, who's our other Jazz writer, to kind of fill in the gaps when it comes to Larry Miller. I did not have any contact with Larry Miller. I started covering the NBA 2 years ago. Larry died in 2009. So everything that I know about Larry is more what I've been told, reporting. But it's actually now become a pretty solid feel for what this guy was like. You know, when you talk to Randy Rigby, the president, when you talk to Kevin O'Connor, the general manager, when you talk to other executives in the league, Larry was very real. No BS. He didn't hold back. He had a vision. He plowed through. He was good in the community. He understood what it meant to represent the Jazz and basically have the Jazz and the Mormon Church symbolize Salt Lake City and Utah for the rest of the world. But at the same time, he worked very, very hard to make a dollar and had a vision and could be uncompromising. Greg Miller told the Salt Lake Tribune that when he took it over in 2009, the company, while it was well-run, while in many ways it was making money, was just a very, very top-down, strict company to where Larry said, hey, this is how we're going to do things, and then everybody else followed. And what Greg's tried to do when there was definitely a transition period, and it wasn't easy at first, especially because of the effects of the recession, and just kind of having to carry that mantle and all that weight forward, was he wanted to be more open. He wanted to take maybe a little more risk in some areas, but also not take as much risk in other areas. And he's tried to, more importantly, involve as many people as possible. And with Randy Rigby, kind of streamlined the two divisions of LHM, which is automotive, insurance, on and on and on, the more business side, and sports and entertainment, which specifically focuses around the Jazz. Mm.
Mike Gorrell, your impressions of the transition between Larry H. Miller, this guy who is a risk taker, and he follows his passions and speaks his mind, and Greg Miller, a little more sedate.
Yeah, you can just picture a situation where back in the old days, Larry would walk into a meeting room and everybody that would be sitting there at the table and just waiting to hear what Larry said. And they wouldn't say anything at all and offer anything up. And Greg is different. Like he relies on those advisors quite a bit. So they go in and have their meetings and everybody gets to give their piece. And he ultimately makes the decision, but it's based on a lot of advice from the people that he's had around him. And many of those people have been around for years and years and years.
You really can't talk about Larry H. Miller without talking about the Utah Jazz. In many Utahns' minds, they are synonymous. Despite the labor issues going on in the league right now, the Jazz do appear to be on solid ground. And in your stories, you note that the team ranked number 3 in sponsorship dollars, came in 2nd in local TV ratings. Why do the Jazz command such loyalty, Mike Gorrell?
They're the great unifying force in Utah. You're either a Utah fan or a BYU fan. You're a Mormon or you're a non-Mormon. But everybody's a Jazz fan.
Hmm. Brian T. Smith?
Yeah, Mike nailed it. I mean, you know, part of this has been building for 2 decades now. You have Karl Malone, you have John Stockton, you have Jerry Sloan. You can't really buy that. That's invaluable. I mean, a sports economist is going to tell you that. A sociologist is going to tell you that. A psychologist is going to tell you that. Anybody who can kind of step away and look at the big picture of sports, it's about branding, it's about loyalty, it's about success. The fact that the Jazz were so good for so long, and a lot of that is a credit to Jerry Sloan and what he helped build with Larry Miller, with Kevin O'Connor, with Randy Rigby, building off what Frank Layden did about 20, 25 years ago. You put all of that together in a small market where you don't have an NFL team, you don't have a Major League Baseball team. Only recently did you get a Major League Soccer team, and they're doing very well, but they're still kind of finding their way and gaining a foothold in the community, even though they're selling out games. RSL right now just cannot compete with the Jazz, and that's not an RSL, that's just a fact. You have 4 major sports. The Jazz are a major sport team, and they even overshadow when they're playing BYU and Utah, and Mike hit it on the nail on the head. I mean, this is something that if the Jazz are in the playoffs, if they're winning It's absolutely contagious, and they're well run, and they treat their fans well. So you put all that together with their TV package, with the fact that Larry went out of his way to kind of combine all facets of game day operations. So there's just this branding effect there to where if you fly into Salt Lake, if you're in Chicago and you see somebody who, you know, mentions Utah, usually the first conversation, and SLC Mayor Ralph Becker talked about this, someone's going to say, "Are you Mormon?" And man, wasn't John Stockton great? And from a sports franchise standpoint, you can't really buy that. I mean, honestly, that is invaluable, and they've done a good job of not trashing that, continuing to win, continuing to at least be competitive, get high-character players in this city, which you have to have in a small market, and they've just built on that through the years.
We're speaking with Brian T. Smith and Mike Gorrell, reporters at the Salt Lake Tribune, and their series of stories on the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies appeared in last Sunday's edition of the paper. You can find links on our website, kcpw.org. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. You mentioned Jazz president Randy Rigby, a veteran of the Larry H. Miller Group. What are his goals for the franchise as we go forward? Mike Gorrell?
I'm going to defer that to Brian.
Okay, Brian.
He deals with them all the time.
Yeah. Randy has very specific goals in mind. Big picture, it's to continue to make money. It's to have the Jazz continue for the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years to be positioned as not just the number one sports team, sports franchise, entertainment franchise in Salt Lake City, but more importantly, to just continue to fine-tune LHM Sports and Entertainment Division so that every dollar is maximized. And you could say, yeah, every business does that, but in a small market franchise in the modern-day sports, 2011, and we're dealing with this right now specifically with the NBA labor situation, you have to maximize your sponsorship value. You have to build brand loyalty. You have to have fans continually signing up for season tickets. And even if they don't think, hey, we're going to win a championship every year, they want to go to the games. They want to be part of that. They want to watch it on television. And the Jazz have done a very, very good job of continuing to build that. And Rigby's trying to streamline everything so there aren't divisions in sports and entertainment. They already have, you know, a TV company, they have a radio station, they have merchandise stores. He's just continued to streamline all that, break down some of the divisions, and just continue to build up the Jazz brand at the same time. Mm.
In your story, you note that Rigby does sort of dismiss Real Salt Lake, calling it a feeder team, basically, for the European Soccer League, comparing it to the Salt Lake Bees. What do you make of that comparison?
You know, there's a fine line there, and I'll stress that came... I speak with Randy quite often, but we spoke with Greg Miller and Randy Rigby for 35 minutes. Then I separately, in a follow-up interview, spoke with Randy for about 20 minutes. That came at the end of the 20-minute interview, which followed the 35-minute interview. Randy wasn't knocking RSL there. He didn't go out of his way to say, hey, we talked about all this stuff, but let me get in a shot at RSL. And that can easily be taken out of context. It was worth including in the story because it was interesting. And Randy's point was that it's up to him as a president. It's up to the Jazz to continue to sell, promote, and show to Salt Lake City, Provo, basically all of Utah that, hey, Real is great. BYU is great. Utah going into the Pac-12, that's great. But big picture, nothing can replicate having a big four sports franchise, whether it be the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, or hockey, in your town. It just can't touch it. And that was Rigby's point. And he came out and said, and we reported this, he said, Real is great. What they're doing is awesome. He's not knocking Real. His point is that, you know, hey, don't get carried away if you're a sports fan and you only have $20 to spend, because what you get big picture from the Jazz really can't be touched by RSL, just in terms of that overall sports marketing feel. And that's something that a president should say, honestly. I mean, if he understands what the Jazz represent, he's trying to sell that, that's his job to promote it. It's his job maybe to get in a little jab at RSL, because you know what? They are feeling a little pressure from RSL. RSL has done very, very well. Dave Chekas has done a tremendous job since he took that team. They're having sellouts. They're in the playoffs. They're winning. The Jazz are in a transition period right now, and it's also occurring while they're not playing games because of the lockout. So they're feeling a little pressure, but I don't think anytime soon you're going to see RSL challenging the Jazz as being the premier sports team in our market.
Mm. Larry Miller, of course, began building his empire on car dealerships. And as we all know, the recession really hit Detroit, the entire auto industry, very hard. How are the dealerships doing, Mike Grell?
They took a pretty good hit during 2008 and 2009. I went back through state tax commission records to see precisely how they were doing. And business dropped off by about 42% by my calculations at the Miller dealerships. They managed to maintain their share of the Utah market. So they actually did a little bit better than that on the used car market sale. So they took a big hit. But 2010 was a better year. 2011 was even better than that. And then this current year looks like it's on pace to get them back to where they would be about like 65-70% of where they were in 2007 when the economy was booming around here.
45 auto dealerships in 7 states,
right,
selling 65,000 vehicles a year. That's still a significant amount of business going on there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They're the 11th biggest automotive group in the country right now. And last year, and many of these figures they provided to Wards, which is an industry publication that came right from the Larry Miller Group. They had $2.5 billion worth of revenue go through their auto business in terms of new car sales, fleet sales, used car sales, body shop work, all kinds of service, accessories, sales, all that. So, yeah, it was a big operation getting bigger. They just added 2 this year.
So what's the secret? How can they maintain and build a business in this, economic environment?
Well, that's been kind of the classic case of what bad economies do is the strong get stronger and the weak go away. And what they've been able to do is that they set about consciously trimming back any fat that they had in the organization. They reduced 16% of their employment during the heat of the recession and got lean and trim and started expanding and moving up into places where others had faltered.
Mm. We're talking about the health of the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. My guest, Mike Grell, he covers Salt Lake County for the Salt Lake Tribune, but he is a major contributor on a series of stories on the Miller Group. Also with us, Brian T. Smith, the Utah Jazz beat writer for the paper. And if you've got questions or comments about Miller's extensive holdings or the effect the NBA lockout is having on Salt Lake City, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Good morning. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Today on the program, a look at Larry H. Miller's empire. Why do you think the Utah Jazz and the Miller car dealerships continue to thrive? 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. With us this hour, Brian T. Smith, Utah Jazz beat writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, Mike Grell, county reporter for the paper, who's been on staff for 28 years, and both have been working on a series of stories on the Miller Holdings. You can find that. There's a link on our website, kcpw.org. You do note in your series of stories that not everything Miller touched turned to gold or is turning to gold. He loved racing cars. He built the Miller Sports Park, but it's not really a moneymaker. Mike Grell, does Greg Miller share his father's love for the racetrack?
Yeah, I think he grew up with vehicles being part of his life, and he might not be as race car oriented as his dad might be, but he clearly likes big off-road vehicles and trucks that he likes to haul down to the desert and things like that. And in terms of Miller Motor Sports Park, he certainly declared that even though it's a problem for them financially, that it's a labor of love and that he's going to continue it. They're not going to turn their backs on it. They're just going to keep going and figure out that maybe somewhere down the line it'll turn out to be something grand.
Mm, what's it going to take to make it an icon, an institution in this market?
Well, I would imagine that it would take a regular series of events that would draw people in on a regular basis, both from anywhere in northern Utah, but throughout the West, because it's kind of a unique facility in terms of there aren't those Le Mans-style tracks in everywhere where people aren't just going around in a circle. They're making left turns and right turns and doing all kinds of things like that, and there's straightaways where so you got bursts of speed and so forth. And I know what Tooele County is counting on right now is that over time that auto manufacturers and people who are into that kind of stuff and are developing the real little nuance things that will make a car go 2 miles faster or brake that much better, do those kinds of things, will start setting up shop and doing research out at that park, and that then you can get some companies springing up around the Tooele area that might be dealing with automotive infrastructure and technological development.
Hmm. We're speaking with Mike Gorrell, Brian T. Smith from the Salt Lake Tribune about their coverage of the Larry H. Miller Group. And let's go to the phones, 801-355-TALK. Anne from Salt Lake City joins us. Anne, hi.
Hi. My question is, if there's a revenue of $2 billion from the Larry H. Miller Group, how do they give back to the city? That's a huge amount of money, and I volunteer for Fourth Street Clinic for the homeless, and I'd love to know how to go about getting my hands on some of that money.
And thanks for the call. Larry Miller, of course, was well known for his philanthropy, his community spirit, community mindedness. Do philanthropic interests remain a priority for the Larry H. Miller Group, Mike Gorrell?
I know that since the recession hit, philanthropic organizations of all kind have had a really rough time, and so I don't know that I can give you an honest comparison of how it is now compared to what it might have been. But I do know I checked on the 990 forms for the Larry H. Miller Charities organization, which has been set up, and they were giving out a lot of money, and there's pages and pages of groups. I wouldn't even be surprised to see your clinic on there at some point. When you look at some of the things that are on here, I can just flipping through some pages right now. There's Suicide Prevention Action Network in Idaho, the Jenna Bears Foundation in Arizona, NAACP, Utah Foster Care, Utah National Guard Charitable Trust. You know, these aren't big sums. They're like $9,000, $2,500, $5,000, Life's Kitchen in Idaho. So, you know, I know that they do give back and a fair amount of money in this one year's form. It's several hundred thousand dollars. So,
Brian T. Smith, anything to add on that account?
Yeah, I'll back what Mike said. I can only speak from my perspective from the Jazz and Sports Entertainment Division, but I know the Jazz are very well known for being very active in the community, and as are most NBA teams. I mean, it's easy to maybe sit back and say, hey, how can I get a piece of that money? I think that's maybe missing the point a little. You know, they're running a business, and they're trying to make a profit, and they're trying to keep people employed during a tough time. If they didn't give back, you would be hearing about it a lot more. They're not overly hoarding their money, and the Jazz, throughout the season, just do a number of philanthropic, community-based projects. And, I mean, they have people specifically tasked to do that and go out of their way to invite people, and people know about it. So, from my perspective, they do a fine job giving back to the community.
And thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. How important, let's put this in the larger context. How important is the financial success of Larry H. Miller companies to Utah's economy as a whole? They're one of the state's largest employers, so their success really kind of reflects how we're all succeeding. Mike Gorrell?
Right. They're the 11th largest private employer in the state in 2010 with 3,700 full-time employees. I guess one of the areas where their reach really extends beyond that is how many people you see in green jackets at jazz games or any kind of events at the Energy Solutions Arena where there are part-time workers. They have another 3,000 company-wide. I'm not exactly sure how that breaks down, but I would imagine that most of those people are here in Utah and they work at functions that are related to the arena. they're also really big in the chambers of commerce in Sandy and do a lot of contributing there and with Jordan Commons, all the activities that revolve around that. So, you know, there are cities that depend on the sales tax revenue that they provide. There are people whose paychecks, certainly a lot, you know, we're talking about 5,000, 6,000 families here.
Brian T. Smith? The overall economic gain that the state overall gets from Larry H. Miller companies.
Mike answered that well. That's more of a business question. What I could kind of, you know, spin that in a way is, and this is one of the main reasons we did this project, was the idea of how does LHM's success affect the Jazz? And the short answer to a very complex question is they provide a buffer. If you're a small market NBA team, and you're losing money, and many, many did last season. 22 out of 30 teams, the NBA says, lost a combined $450 million, which is a lot of money. I mean, they're bleeding red. If you have LHM, if you have all this diversity, and this is what Greg Miller and Renner Rigby told the Salt Lake Tribune, it builds a wall. And so you can kind of get through the tough times. And Randy Rigby had a great point. Greg Miller backed it. He's basically said that, you know, throughout LHM's history, there have been times when the automotive division has kind of carried Jazz basketball. There's been times where it's been split. There's been times where Jazz basketball, especially, let's say, Stockton Malone are in the finals. You know, you get all these extra playoff games. Usually NBA teams make about $1 million for every home playoff game now. There have been times when the Jazz have carried the automotive side, the business side. Right now, it's the former. Right now, the automotive side, everything from, you know, insurance to the merchandise source, the movie theaters, their whole LHM brand is helping the Jazz. The Jazz do well comparatively, especially when you look at other small market teams. They do very well in local TV ratings. They have a pretty good TV deal. The Lakers have an amazing TV deal. The Lakers have a TV deal they just signed last year. That's 20 years, $3 billion. The Jazz's runs through 2020, 2021 with DirecTV's Root Sports. It's a good deal, but comparatively speaking, it's about $200 to $300 million. So it's just very, very hard for a small market team to make a profit right now, which is why we're in a lockout, which is why they're having these 15-hour meetings, which I was covering last night. And last till 4 a.m, and you put all that together, and you've got to have a company backing your team, whether it's based around casinos, whether it's based around insurance, whatever it is. But you've got to have a situation to where the team can lose a little money or a lot of money, and they can continue to survive because overall the company is doing well, and that's exactly what LHM is doing right now.
Mm. We're speaking with Brian T. Smith and Mike Gorrell from the Salt Lake Tribune about their in-depth report on the Larry H. Miller group of companies. Gail Miller, Larry's wife, Greg's mother, what is her role in the empire right now? What do we know? Mike Gorrell?
Well, I know that she is quite active in all of their functions out there. They opened up a theater and the new Toyota dealership in Murray, and Gail was there. And by all accounts, she is active in all of the business and other discussions that they have among the main players of the company.
Brian T. Smith, is she having much influence on the team, on Jazz business?
Yeah. In terms of day-to-day operations, that is, you know, more tiered and it's more structured. And that's, you know, Kevin O'Connor, Randy Rigby, Tyrone Corbin, they run the Jazz. Greg Miller helps run the Jazz. And if they have a minor situation, you know, Greg Miller is aware of it. If they have a major situation, Greg Miller is aware of it. Gail Miller seems to only really be brought in if something monumental occurs with the Jazz, and that would be the Deron Williams trade. That would be Jerry Sloan's resignation last year. Those were two things that people are going to be talking about in this community for the next 5 to 10 to 20 to 50 years. Gail Miller was a part of both of those. I mean, during the press conference when Jerry Sloan basically overnight, while it had been building for months, basically overnight decided that he was going to resign from the Jazz, Gail Miller all of a sudden shows up, and she's at the press conference the next day, and she's at that table. And right there, you're seeing that she still has a spot with the Jazz. Same thing with the Deron Williams trade. While she didn't pull the trigger, while Gail wasn't, you know, involved in the day-to-day process, that was Kevin O'Connor, the GM, who Greg Miller trusts to basically run the team on a day-to-day basis. Gail Miller was involved in that trade in the sense of she was kind of brought in before they did pull the trigger. Some teams wouldn't do that if you had an absentee type of owner. Gail Miller isn't that. While she's not hands-on day-to-day, she still wants to be aware of the major things that happen, and she, in some ways, had to green light the Darren Williams trade. I don't know if she had been against it, if they had still gone through. My gut is, yeah, they would have. They would have found a way to kind of massage it and work it. But she was aware of it. She actually had the question, you know, hey, why are we trading our all-star player? But once it was explained to her, you know, we're getting cash back on the dollar. We're getting future prospects. We're getting draft picks. We're able to kind of get maximum value for an all-star in return. She understood that. And more importantly, you know, while Gail has declined to interview with Crest for the Tribune, she's not this empty figurehead that you do see with sports franchises. And Mike just pointed out, she still goes to community functions. I've been told that she's still, you know, active, especially on the more the business side of things. And she was recently at a movie theater opening. So Gail is still active. She's just not as visible as she once was.
One final point before we have to end this segment. Larry Miller, of course, willing to take risks, wore his heart on his sleeve. An obituary by your colleague Steve Lum quotes him saying that if he had to stop and think about buying that first Toyota franchise, he said, it would have scared me. I probably would not have done it. So he kind of acted on instinct. I'm wondering if you see that same entrepreneurial, risk-taking spirit in his successors. And Mike Gorrell?
I probably wouldn't count on it being nearly as adventurous as Larry might have been. But I know that Greg was pretty, he got pretty hepped up when he got to talking about the convenience stores that he has pictured for development over the next while. They've got one in existence right now, but he wants to develop a whole set that have like real big long bays, so that if you're pulling a trailer behind your truck, you can fill up with gas easy enough, and you can go inside and see these big screen TVs that are showing action sports, and it could be stuff that your friends sent in from their trip to the desert a week ago, and how they'd have kiosks in there where you can buy jazz tickets and movie tickets and anything that the Miller Empire has to offer. And so, you know, you could tell that there was a little bit of his vestige of his dad in him right there in the enthusiasm he showed for describing that convenience store.
Brian T. Smith, risk-taking, still alive and well at the Millers?
I think that right now in this economy, I mean, anybody who's taking enormous risk, and if they're running the type of company that LHM is running, they're not doing their job correctly. I think anybody would tell you that. I mean, you can't just be wild and crazy. You could if you're a startup, you could if you're into venture capitalism or something like that. But if you're running a multi-state, multi-billion company, you can't just be opening businesses left and right or doing things on a whim. I think Greg is still coming into his own as the head of LHM, as the figurehead for the Jazz. He seems to be becoming more and more comfortable as each month goes by. Even just kind of being around Greg and kind of seeing him operate, talking to him, it takes a while for him to kind of warm up to you and I don't want to say trust you. I mean, I'm not personal friends with Greg Miller, but to be able to speak. But actually, after covering the Jazz for more than a year, having numerous sit-downs with Greg, I think I've had three extended sit-down conversations with him in the last year. He's coming around. He's coming around dealing with the media. He's coming around running the Jazz. He has a vision. I think, you know, you put anybody in those shoes, and if they're the son of Larry Miller and they're taking over LHM and the Jazz, that's not very easy to do. And then you compound that with the recession and the change in the NBA. Greg Miller's got a lot to figure out. He's relied on other people to help him get through this process, but I do think he's starting to kind of get his legs, get his confidence, kind of find his voice. It's still a work in progress. But the most important thing is that he hasn't made any, you know, humongous errors this far. So they have a foundation right now. Hopefully the economy settles in, but they've even found that, you know, a way to weather that, continue to make money during the uncertainty. And if they can continue to do that on the operative side, the automotive side, the business side, and then get the Jazz back to a team that, you know, isn't just maybe getting to the playoffs, but actually has a chance to get to the NBA Finals once every 5 to 10 years, he'd be doing a pretty good job.
Brian T. Smith, Mike Gorrell, reporters for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much, gentlemen, for your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Their series of stories on the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies appeared in last Sunday's edition of the paper. You can find links on our website, kcpw.org. Up next, Layers and Layers, a conversation with the artist Kim Schoenstad. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Her work has been described as collaborative, process-oriented, and architecturally based. Now artist Kim Schoenstad is bringing her vision to the Salt Lake Arts Center for an exhibit showcasing her work over the past decade. And joining me now in studio, Kim Schoenstad. She's a painter based in Venice, California, whose work has been featured in galleries from Los Angeles to Chicago to Munich. She's the winner of the Catherine Doctorow Prize for Contemporary Painting from Salt Lake Arts Center. And Kim Schoenstad, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much. It's also a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Adam Price, Executive Director of the Salt Lake Arts Center. Adam, hi.
Hi, Jennifer.
And the exhibit featuring a selection of Schoenstad's work will open, is it next Thursday?
The official opening for the public is next Friday.
Next Friday at the Salt Lake Arts Center. We'll have more details on that on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments for the artist about technique, place, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Kim Schoenstad, your work has, it's multi-layered. Talk about this obsession with layers and what intrigues you about peeling away paint, drawings, the remnants of history.
Well, it really started in Poland. I was invited to be part of the Biennale, and I didn't know anything about Poland, and I asked them to send me pictures of things they found interesting, and they sent me photos of architecture. I then realized that the Soviet brutalist architecture and the California modernist architecture had a conversation going on. And that's how I got hooked in juxtaposing the two places. Hmm. So for this show, I created many new pieces, and I did a fair amount of research into Salt Lake architecture, which is fantastic.
Talk about a place, and when much of your work is site-based, it relates to the location where it will be shown. How do you approach the research that goes into it? You said for this piece, you're looking at Salt Lake City architecture. What were some of the buildings that struck you, and how do you just go about looking at a place with fresh eyes and figuring out what to incorporate into your work?
Yeah, going back to Poland, the thing that got me hooked on that concept was people walked into the exhibition and they instantly related to it. They had an in into the work. It's rather complicated work. And so having that ability to look at something and say, I know that, was really important, an important moment for me as an artist. Mm. And that's sort of how I got interested in, back to the layering issue of layering. You know, you add this and then this and then this. And as long as people can have their in, then they can start to dissect the work. The architecture that I found really, like, there was too much in Salt Lake, really. I had to narrow it down. And some of the pieces that I used, there are several pieces I just drove past on South Temple, the IBM building and the Western General building. There's also some local architects that are doing fantastic work, Axis Architects, and I use their H House. There are also two buildings on East Bench that I used. We haven't identified them, so if anybody knows what they are, we're happy to know that. And then also the Jennings House and the Pingree House. And the Salt Lake Modern also helped provide a lot of source material. Their Flickr site is fantastic. They have amazing images of Salt Lake architecture. The curatorial staff at the Art Center was amazing in helping provide images because the exhibition time was rather brief, so I didn't have time to come out and drive around and do the normal. So they were really excellent in facilitating.
But what is it about an image or a structure that calls out to you? What makes something unique or, mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It's two things. The visual, of course, but the history. So, like, the IBM building had it's this building with all of these scalloped windows, and that was really structurally beautiful, but then it also reminded me of a typewriter, like, you know. And then I also liked that it was this big corporate building, but it didn't look like a big giant monolith. It was really interesting. And I like that about each of the buildings, they have an interesting history to them as well.
Describe your style of painting. Again, this is radio, so if you can put it in visual terms, what would I see if I look at your work?
The way that I begin a work is that I begin from a photograph. In the brochure for the exhibition, we've listed all of the local Salt Lake architecture, and so you can see the photographs that I used as my source material. I make a drawing of that. I then make a transparency of that drawing, and I use an old-fashioned light table, and I do a mashup of all of these different architectural places. That's the beginning of the painting. So I've gone through all this process just to get to the beginning of making the painting. And then I start introducing random elements. I mean, just interruptions and color and sculptural parts. One of the pieces for the exhibition has, at the top of the entrance for the Salt Lake Arts Center, there's this sort of strange triangular glass thing that comes out. And honestly, I couldn't quite understand what it was, but I thought it was kind of a cool structure and geometric, and it was an interesting interruption into the architecture, and so I used it as an interruption into the architectural mashup.
As I'm looking at some of the pieces that you've done, they're almost mural-like. They extend along walls, they spill over onto the floor. They're just, it almost becomes like it's part of the space, which is really, really intriguing. Do you consider yourself a painter, or do you consider yourself more multimedia?
I consider myself an artist. People need to identify things, and so sometimes it's helpful to say I'm a painter or this is a drawing, but in general I'm an artist because I don't feel as though it's necessarily limited. But my mom calls me a painter, so I'm a painter.
You got to listen to your mom. We're speaking with Kim Schoenstatt. She is a painter, and her new exhibit is going to be unveiled at the Salt Lake Arts Center next Friday. She is the winner of this year's Catherine Doctorow Prize for Contemporary Painting from Salt Lake Arts Center. Adam Price, tell us about this prize. This is the first year that you've awarded it.
Yeah, this is a fantastic opportunity that's really been made available to us and to the residents of Salt Lake City through the generosity of the Doctorow Family Foundation. It's a chance for Salt Lake City to become a recognized center for contemporary painting throughout the United States and hopefully the world. The prize consists of a $15,000 cash award to the recipient and a solo show at the Arts Center. And I think it's a great way for us to extend out into the world to develop our networks within the contemporary art community. And then also an amazing opportunity for residents of Utah to see some of the very best painters in the world who are coming onto the scene today and to bring them in. And the prize will be every other year. This is the first, and we're just thrilled to have Kim Schoenstatt as the inaugural recipient.
What really caught your attention about her work?
You know, I think a lot of things, but there's ways in which that you've alluded to that she breaks the traditional plane of painting, right? That the painting spills out onto the floor and onto the ceiling is sort of the very literal way in which it happens. But she also incorporates, a variety of media into the painting, expanding the world of painting, sound, audience participation, performance. And then there is that participatory quality that we actually, Kim does invite members of the public to come by to add to the painting, to contribute their piece. And it explores in a very interesting way, I think, ideas of authorship. Who is the creator of a work of art and how does it get created? So I think there's a lot that she's doing that's really groundbreaking. In some ways, it's emblematic of what's happening in the contemporary community right now. And in some ways, it's really treading new ground in some very exciting ways.
I'm interested in hearing more about this collaboration. Why invite writers, artists, simple spectators like me to participate in a very active way in your art? What is the appeal for you as an artist?
I spend a lot of time alone in my studio. and it's a great way for me to get out of my head, to expand my horizons, and to see what happens. I mean, it started as sort of an art experiment where I didn't know what to do to this one canvas. I mean, I had done this like meticulous mashup of architecture and it was doing this thing, and then I wanted some color in there, but I was really afraid of color at the time. And so I thought, well, I'll just get other people to tell me what to do. And as a child growing up, I went to the Art Institute in Chicago, and I wanted to play too. And so I thought, well, that would be fun, you know, and then people could tell me what to do, and I'd do it, and I'd learn some things and some techniques, and it worked. And that's another moment where I had that aha moment of, like, this is really cool. This is fun. It's involving other people. It's getting them into the work. And I'm particularly excited about the a couple new pieces for this exhibition. The Paint by Numbers piece is a piece, it's a black wall with a white vinyl drawing on it. And then the audience can, there's colors painted on the wall and numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The audience can take a piece of chalk, draw a shape on the wall, and then number it. At the end of the week, you're going to have a bunch of shapes with numbers, and then a gallery staff paints by number. And over time, you're going to see a layering process of this beautiful collaboration between the piece and the public, and you'll see where what areas are more often sought after, you know, and you're limited to how high you can go. So we'll also see the height of your residence.
That's one thing that I'd really noticed about your work is it's very evolutionary. Like, you can see a piece at the beginning and it's nothing like it was at the end. I mean, it kind of morphs and changes throughout the exhibition period. That must be, I don't know, kind of exciting to see that as an artist.
It's really nice, and it also echoes life.
We're speaking with Kim Schoenstatt. She's a painter based in Venice, California. Her exhibit here at the Salt Lake Arts Center will open next week. Also with us, Adam Price, executive director of the Salt Lake Arts Center. What was your reaction to winning the doctoral prize?
I was elated and floored. It was a true honor. I mean, I had a sense of my competition because artists talk to each other. We check in on each other. What are you up to? How's that curator to work with? Blah, blah, blah. So I knew my competition, and I was pretty convinced I wasn't going to get it. And so when I got the call from Adam, I was just like, no way. It was really...
Is that how you remember it, Adam?
Pretty much.
Who are your artistic influences?
Oh my goodness, that ranges both ways. Let's see. Contemporary artists, of course, my mentor, John Baldessari, Lawrence Weiner, Katerina Grossa, Karen Sander. Going back a bit, there's Matisse, of course. There is Warhol. There's, holy cow. how long do we have?
It sounds like the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything and anything. Tony Smith, I'm really obsessed with his sculptures right now. Saul LeWitt is a huge art hero. He's definitely an art hero for me.
I want to play a clip. This is a clip that I was sent about your exhibits. Maybe you can set it up and we'll take a listen. What will we be hearing?
What you're hearing is a sound drawing, and this piece I created with a sound engineer. I had him, Mike, me, making a drawing. And I'm looking forward, actually, to continuing this series of work because I want to now do a series of sound paintings.
Let's take a listen. This is Kim Schoenstatt. You say this is the sound of you drawing. What are you drawing with?
I'm drawing with a pencil, and it's on paper, and it's really rough paper. and it's a really hard pencil. And it actually, there's a whole, this is part of a whole series where I did different media, different pencils, different pastels, different papers, different surfaces. And this particular, the subject matter for this one is the car crash series. And it was a series of drawings that I had taken from crime scene photographs.
Hmm. So you're tracing these photographs?
No, it's the same thing. I have the photograph in front of me, and then I make a freehand drawing of it.
Why record the sound of your art?
I was curious as to how your experience with it would change. So when you're experiencing this piece, what you see in front of you is a graphite outline of the size of that particular drawing. You don't see the drawing, you hear the drawing. And the idea is that maybe you'll visually fill in. You're hearing each line being drawn, so maybe you can visually make up the drawing.
Catherine, Kim Schoenstatt, she is the winner of this year's doctoral prize from the Salt Lake Arts Center. Kim, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Adam Price, executive director of the Salt Lake Arts Center, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Kim's exhibit will open next week at the Arts Center. More details on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Jesse Ellis and Beth Clifford. And tomorrow it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Tune in for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.